You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 136 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Hello.
Hello? It's a hi.
Welcome back. You were gone for a day, which is why this podcast is a day later than normal. And do you know what you missed out on?
What did I miss out on?
You missed out on something we need to toast to right now.
So let's get into our beer.
We have here, we previously did a Silver City Winter Beer, but it was not the Silver City Winter Beer, which is their Silver City Wonderland Winter Lager.
The Silver City Winter Beer.
It's kind of like the Ohio State University. Frightful weather is no match for Wonderland. A blend of five different malts lends a deep, rich color and mild roast character.
Do you need to start over?
Maybe I
need to teach you how to read?
You do. Refined by 5 weeks of lagering at near freezing temperature. And the famous Cousin Katie knows I was reading at age two.
Reading at age two? No, you weren't.
Something like that.
You're not reading at age two. Consider me skeptical about this.
Consider me skeptical about whether I ever said it was actually going to be the best week in Seattle sports history.
There are tapes. This is recorded.
I said most important.
I can't open up. You can't read. I can't open up a bottle anymore.
Really off to a flying start here.
We're woozy after that video earlier. Oh, there we go. That's malty. Okay, so what is it that we're toasting to?
Well, it was the most important day in South End Dick's history.
Okay. I guess I'll give you that.
The grand opening of the Dicks in Kent. We have been monitoring the story. I can't even remember when the vote was anymore. I'm pretty sure it was while we were doing the search
Sonics
for Seattle's
were still
best
here.
Burger. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was while we were doing the search for Seattle's best burger 2 years ago, where of course Dicks won the fan vote, although not technically our vote. But nonetheless, so exciting to see. There's not been any south of even, you know, the heart of downtown. Like, the farthest south location is the Capitol Hill location. So this is a big jump to call them all the way down to Kent.
Which is south of Queen Anne, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But maybe
there's some Peltoncast geography.
There was. Maybe came a little bit too far south. We would have preferred, I don't know,
They went too far.
This time they've gone too far.
You know what? If I could give Dix a suggestion, Boulevard Park.
Just all sorts of dicks, like 30 of them. That's
I don't want too many.
I got to tell you, so I was in attendance, of course, for the grand opening there.
Of course, which, if you want to see video footage of, go to the Peltoncast Instagram and watch. Did you save it as a video?
I sure did.
There we go.
Story, yeah.
If you're not following the Peltoncast on Instagram,
what are you
even doing?
Maybe you're not on Instagram.
No. Start an Instagram account and go follow the Peltoncast on Instagram.
Yeah, that's fair, actually. That is completely fair.
There you go.
Okay, although, because it's a story, you can just actually go watch the saved story now.
There's other content
happening.
I get
it. I get that. So I got there. The festivities started at 10 a.m. I got there at 10:15.
There we go. And peak burger time.
A little crowd starting to form. It got substantially larger as time went on. And I was like up in the front, which is why the original like video of the Kennedy Catholic Marching Band going by, like that's really
Shout
solid.
To Sam Heward.
But then by the time they were behind a ribbon and a rope, you know, essentially, and when they took that down and allowed us to move forward, a bunch of people pushed past me, therefore I did not have a very good view of the ribbon cutting or a place at the front of the line when they finally opened up for business at 10:30.
How many people would you estimate were there in line?
I'm terrible at estimating crowd size. I think that's one of my worst attributes. But I would say, you know, a few hundred.
All right.
No, it was definitely a good crowd. Like, there was nothing. My favorite part of it, they had, because of, you know, the popularity, they put limits on what you could order.
Oh.
20 burgers and 10 fries. Which, like, a lot of people in the around me in line had said, like, overhearing them talking to other people, they had told their coworkers, hey, I'm going to this. Can I bring you back something? So they did, in fact, have orders larger than 20 burgers that they needed to split up.
So you were only able to get 20 burgers.
Yeah, fortunately
wouldn't have been able to have lunch.
I know. Fortunately, my order...
He would needed the fries, though, so maybe they'd let him do 40 burgers.
True. Fortunately, my order of a deluxe 2 cheeseburgers and a strawberry shake was safely under those established
limits. Deluxe 2 cheeseburgers and a strawberry shake.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was delicious. It was some of the best tasting Dick's burgers I've ever had, I would say.
Wow.
So the quality has not gone downhill with the move to the South End, not whatsoever, or with the massive rush. I mean, you can imagine how many burgers they're having to pump out with a line of this size.
That's actually probably a good thing.
Because you're getting really fresh, but yeah, you're always getting fresh food.
It is true. You're almost always getting fresh food. But if there's one thing that I've understood about food from especially hearing Chris talk and talking Taco Time, is that, yes, it sucks going at the peak time to things, but you're almost always getting the freshest food.
Yes.
In the fast food world.
Yes. My other takeaway here was, man, I cannot imagine how often we would have gone to Dick's for lunch if this had existed when I was in high school at Mount Rainier.
Is it really close?
I mean, it's basically across the street from Highline Community College.
It's in Midway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not far from Mount Rainier. It's like a 10-minute drive, probably. Like, I passed, as I turned off from I-5 up onto Pack Highway South, I passed the Burger King and the Pizza Hut that we used to go to for lunch. So it's not, like, far from that.
Imagine when I was going to Highline Community College, though.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever ate one time in the city of Midway. Like, it just wasn't a thing that I did.
Yeah, the church's chicken probably wasn't even there yet.
I would have eaten church's chicken, maybe.
It was fine. I went there once.
So you're telling me that it would not be inappropriate to say that Dick's Burgers just taste better in the South Side?
It would not be. Absolutely. I would toast again.
Wow.
To that particular
statement. Retoasting. I'm going to have to find out soon.
Yeah. You gotta pay homage. Pay a visit. I did, on the food topic, want to discuss one other thing.
Walk through Highline Community College and reminisce about how upset I was when George Bush was reelected in 2006?
Four.
Yeah.
That's the cast timeline right there.
About what was either a positive or negative midterms in 2006?
Yes. It's always so amazing to walk the same halls as Brian Scalabrine.
Yes, yes.
The other food thing I wanted to tell you about.
Yes.
So a few weeks ago, got a note on Twitter from perhaps the listener, certainly to some extent the listener, sounding off in the sound, at off sounding, you need to revise your Seattle taco rankings.
Really?
Carmelo's, pretty sure not Anthony related, tacos are everything Chuki's does right, but with fresh handmade tortillas.
Hmm.
And I can also pinpoint when this tweet came, because to vouch for their food credentials.
There's a timestamp on it.
No. Not to vouch for their food
credentials. I can pinpoint almost down to the minute when this tweet came.
I can triangulate it. We have the science. This person sent a photo.
Like, that night in 1995, the Mariners were playing.
This person sent a photo of the mac and cheeseburger from Lil Woody's that they were enjoying at the time they sent this tweet. So I recognize
the credit.
They were
enjoying the mac and cheeseburger and telling you about Carmelo's tacos?
Yeah.
Who is this person?
It's the only time that I've
recalled. What was their Twitter handle again?
At off sounding.
At off sounding?
Yes.
Wow. Well, you truly are the listener for that move right there.
It clearly appears so. So I went and looked up this location.
Yes.
Which is on Capitol Hill, not far from the original Tacos Chuki's. It's located in like a mini mart, like convenience store there. I think the Hillcrest Market.
Okay.
And the reviews are off the charts phenomenal. So it only opened a couple months ago, which is why it was not in our search for Seattle's best taco. It hadn't yet filtered onto our radar by the point we completed that search. But it definitely seemed like a place that needed to be considered or reviewed. So this past Friday, along with Third Pelton brother Jake One and loyal listener Damon.
You went with Jake One?
I sure did.
And Damon?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
We were watching some NBA games nearby. and walk down to the market to pick up some Carmelo's tacos.
You and Jake Warner hanging out casually?
Yeah, that's the
thing. And not inviting me?
He did wonder where you were, and I was like, he's with his 10 to 15 children, okay?
Jake Warner should understand. He has a number of children.
Not nearly as large a number.
Does he have one child?
I think so, yes. Right. So they do, in fact, have homemade tortillas, corn tortillas.
Hmm.
And even though I'm not usually as big a fan of the corn tortillas, the flour tortilla, these were really good corn tortillas. I think maybe even the highlight of the tacos. I would say that I got two al pastor, I think one steak, and then a chorizo. I would say the meat was not quite as good as Tacos Chuki's, but definitely very solid. I would say that, and Jake, his take, he thought that they were, he couldn't say for sure whether or not they were better than Tacos Chuki's.
Wow.
My take is that...
A hot Jake.
Okay. I thought they would probably be, just based on my preliminary assessment, probably be a Final Four contender in our search for Seattle's best tacos / burrito. So it's definitely a place worth checking out that you're going to have to get to and get back to us with your assessment of this location.
Well, I am very curious. I mean, you know, we wouldn't reopen our search for Seattle's best tacos / burrito, but we're always competing to find the best even after we've...
Obviously. Look, that search never stops. You're either competing or you're not.
Even after we've crowned the champion of all of these searches, we're always looking for what could be better, right?
Yes.
So I was in LA the last couple of days and had like three meals, right? And two of them were at the same place, actually two different locations of the same place.
What was that?
And that is Home State, a Texas kitchen. Have you been there before?
I have not been there.
There's one in Highland Park, apparently one in what they consider Hollywood, like Los Feliz or whatever. It is excellent. To me, it's significantly better than Guisado's.
Really?
So it's tacos. I'll tell you why. Because we don't really have breakfast tacos in Seattle.
We never tried. One thing we never got to in our search for Seattle's best taco, Jack's Barbecue does breakfast tacos.
Oh, and yeah. I desperately want to try those. We should go there. I heard Jack's is expanding.
Yes, they are. I think there's a Jack's in South Lake Union that's going in.
So at Home State, they have homemade flour tortillas that are right there. They are thick and warm and gooey. And it's all I want in the world.
Okay, that sounds really good.
Right? And they have 24 hours a day. I don't know if it's actually 24 hours a day. Anytime that they're open, they have breakfast tacos. And you can look at these options right here.
I'm seeing some good options there.
And then they also have anytime tacos, including a brisket taco.
I'm interested.
Which I had yesterday, and it was excellent. Then I went back today for breakfast and got two breakfast tacos.
Nice.
They're kind of like little, and they come in the foil, right? Like warm in the foil. The place that it reminds me the most of is Veracruz All Natural.
That's immediately what I was going to ask you, which is how they compare to that.
I mean, I last year at South by Southwest, I didn't have the best Veracruz experience. It was almost too long of a wait.
That seems reasonable.
This year, I'm probably staying at a place that's like 0.3 miles from the Veracruz.
Nice.
Where it's like, I'm going to be there a lot. So I'll probably have a great experience again because I'll be able to go at the right time or whatever instead of like I'd walked like a mile last year.
Yes.
It just wasn't like a great situation. But these Home State tacos that I had the last 2 days to me were better than the Veracruz tacos.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to make it a point. I'm going to be in LA a couple of times early in January. I will have to make it a point to eat these tacos.
We're going to go. We're going to go when we're both down
we'll
for back to back.
Okay.
And we're going to go to the Home State tacos.
Outstanding.
It was excellent. I had a Topo Chico, had tacos. It was a great morning.
That sounds quite great. Okay, we had a lot of food talk. Needed to get through it. But we got to get to sports because all of the sports are happening right now for whatever reason. There's so much sports happening.
Sort of.
There's like I have so you know I have different categories for each team, including the NHL expansion team and NBA in Seattle. Literally every single one is filled this week.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how often that happens, but it can't be too often. we start with some surprising NBA news, where on Wednesday, Arizona Republic columnist Lori Roberts reported that Suns owner Robert Sarver has told some members of the Phoenix City Council that he will move the team to Seattle or Las Vegas if funding for a $230 million planned renovation of Talking Stick Resort Arena is not approved. Suns president Jason Rowley that later refuted that report, telling reporters, "The reality is that we have made zero threats about going to any other city."
Yeah, because you don't make the threats publicly.
Of course not.
You make the threats privately.
He also said it was illogical for them to make threats about it because of the fact that they've been negotiating on these renovations. And it's like, look, you could say that you didn't make the threats. I may or may not believe you. I don't believe you, but don't insult my intelligence by telling me it's not logical to use the threat of moving to get a better deal with the city.
We know when you're supposed to issue threats.
That's the whole game, my friend. That's the entire thing.
That's the whole game.
And I don't really have an issue with it. Like, some people, like, people describe it as bullying or blackmail. Like, it's just a negotiation. That's what you do. You use your leverage in a negotiation.
Well, you know, sometimes people don't say it because of the implication, right?
Right.
Like, you don't need to say the words Seattle and Las Vegas exist whether you make the threat or not.
Which is funny. That's sort of what he also said in that comment. He was like, look, it's common knowledge that Seattle, he said $700 million. We'll get to that in a second. I guess we won't. We talked about that last week, that it's already over $800 million for the cost of the renovation of Key Arena at this point. And then talked about Las Vegas having a new arena. Like, common knowledge. Like, yeah, it is common knowledge. So we know why it's common knowledge, because those are places you would go if you didn't get this. So the reason this is coming up right now is that the Phoenix City Council was scheduled on Wednesday to vote on this plan for the renovation of Talking Stick Resort Arena.
When was Talking Stick Resort Arena built?
Later in the notes. We'll get to that in a second. Okay. But the answer is 1992.
What has it been called? It was called
America West Arena.
America West.
U.S. Airways Center.
Okay.
And then, was there anything between U.S. Airways Center? I don't think there was anything between that.
Is Talking Stick Resort Arena the worst name of an arena in the world?
It's probably not the worst name for an arena. It is very confusing. I talked to a reporter once who was going to cover some games there. Did not realize that it was the same arena as the U.S. Airways Center. Thought that it was out on the casino. Because it's actually, you know what it's actually very similar to?
What?
The fact that the former Everett Arena is now the Angel of the Winds Arena. Same thing, where it sounds like it's on the grounds of the casino that it's named after. But anyways, so this plan was scheduled for a vote on Wednesday afternoon from the Phoenix City Council, which is all that needs to approve it. Does not need to go to a public vote. But the plan had only been revealed to the public on Thursday night, not giving taxpayers very much opportunity to understand the plan or weigh in on it, deliver feedback to their council members. So both the interim mayor and members of the council asked for a delay to this vote, which was chosen. It was granted. And the expectation is now that they will, in fact, vote on it on January 23rd at the next full media of council, which would allow a couple of community meetings to be scheduled in the interim to get feedback from the public, which, from the sounds of things, is very skeptical of giving this much money to the Suns to renovate the arena.
The Phoenix public?
Yes.
Interesting. And so that council, it just has to be a 4-3 vote, right?
Yes.
This is not unanimous.
And so there's three members that have come out and said publicly they will not vote for it.
Okay.
And there was a fourth who issued a statement on Tuesday night that was kind of wishy-washy, but basically indicated concerns about the fact that the public doesn't understand this and hasn't been able to weigh in.
Uh-huh.
So that was the kind of the impetus for delaying this vote.
Who made the choice to delay it? The council?
I think they did vote on it. Yes.
They voted on whether to delay it.
I think so.
Okay.
So, as you mentioned, the arena opened in 1992. It underwent minor renovations in 2001 and 2002, but is one of the oldest arenas in the league. And there is a general consensus in looking at the commentary here that, you know, some sort of update to this arena needs to be done. There was talk at one point about a replacement NBA-NHL arena in downtown Phoenix. That did not have much momentum. So I think at this point it's kind of renovation or bust. The current lease, it runs through 2032, but there's an opt-out in 2022. So hence the urgency to try to get something done right now. And the Suns, as part of this agreement on the renovation deal that is being voted on, would commit to extending their lease through 2037 with an option to add another 5 years to that, taking them through 2042. So I would say this all sounds very familiar to me to a couple situations. Number one, obviously, is the Sonics. Because, you know, I tweeted out earlier a column in the Arizona Republic suggesting that, you know, the NBA would never let the Suns move. They've been there for 50 years. Jerry Colangelo, who has great pull in
the
league
office.
They've
been there for 50 years in Phoenix?
They celebrated their 50th anniversary last year.
Have they ever won a championship?
They have not.
Wow!
They are probably by far the most successful franchise in the NBA not to have won a championship. Huh. Like, went to the finals a couple times and lost. Have generally had very competitive teams until the last few years here. But just never broke through with a championship. But anyway, they cited the longevity, Jerry Colangelo's influence. But look, what we learned with the Sonics is nobody is safe.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't step up and figure out an arena solution, like, the NBA will not hesitate to move the team. But I would say the other situation this kind of feels familiar to me with is the Mariners in their negotiations on the new lease for Safeco Field. So in a very fairly similar situation where, you know, we need, in Safeco case, it's not necessarily a renovation so much as upkeep, but we need this money. It's a publicly built arena that's being run privately. And there's interest from both sides in continuing this relationship. So I think one possibility is that, you know, over the next month here, month and plus before January 23rd, we may just see, you know, the allocation of money changes a little bit. Maybe it's, you know, instead of the Suns kicking in $80 million and the state or the city kicking in $150 million for the actual renovation, you know, maybe it's 100 and 130 or something closer to a 50-50 split, which is what ultimately ended up happening with the Mariners and Safeco Field.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess my main question for you is this would still be Robert Sarver. He still wants to own the team.
Absolutely.
Is he from Phoenix?
He is from Phoenix, yes.
They're probably not moving. But it seems unlikely that it's going to happen unless they've made these threats or whatever and the city council is just hardline no, right? If they're not willing to give anything or to negotiate, and all of a sudden Robert Sarver's gone too far, maybe farther than he anticipated, wanted to make some threats, but the city is just like, we're not backing down. We're digging in our heels because of, they can look at it and be like, look at what the deal and the people in Seattle got.
Exactly.
Right? Like, on both sides, there are precedents. The issue is the precedent that Seattle has set with getting arenas built privately also required the team to go away.
Exactly. And I mean, that's kind of the thing here, is on the one hand, it's like, look, Phoenix, you can't take the threat of the team moving lightly. But on the other hand, I don't think that means you should just cave in and take whatever it is the Suns are demanding. I mean, you still have a certain degree of leverage in the fact that it is expensive and painful to move a team. And I don't think you should necessarily be hesitant to explore that.
A team in Seattle, though, let's say the value of the Suns is what?
I think it just topped a billion.
$1 billion. A team in Seattle is worth more than $1 billion.
Slightly more. I mean, that's the other similarity here is I think Phoenix is similar in terms of it's a case where, you know, they haven't necessarily built arenas within or stadia within the city limits itself, other than America West, which is now pretty old. And then the nearby Chase Field where the Diamondbacks play. And that's also, you know, pretty old at this point. But they have recently built in Glendale a new stadium for the Cardinals, as well as the arena at which the Phoenix Coyotes play after they moved out of the arena that they were sharing with the Suns, which wasn't really designed for hockey. A lot of similarities to Key Arena here.
What is the interest in the team right now in Phoenix?
Well, it's pretty low because they've been terrible for several years.
Because they're awful.
They have the worst record in the Western Conference by a mile, and there's not a lot of tolerance of Robert Sarver at this point, given, you know, the way he oversaw the breakup of the 7 seconds or less team and their complete lack of success in the last 6 years or so.
Passing on Luka Doncic. The thing is, there was some conversation, which, granted, I think everybody in Seattle is getting ahead of themselves at this point, right?
Way ahead of themselves.
We're miles ahead of ourselves. At the same time, like, this is the situation that the NBA has put us in, right? where like they have basically told us that it doesn't seem like expansion is coming, at least anytime soon.
Yep.
They're making us cheer for negotiations to fall through in these other cities, right? And they like the idea of having Seattle there, Vegas there as a threat, because it means that the Suns or whomever is going, they're going to get better deals than they would otherwise.
I mean, I do want to say, I don't, you know, there's some theory, oh, that, you know, it's like the NFL in Los Angeles. They don't want to put a team there because then you don't have the threat of moving to a team to Seattle.
So they're going to put five teams in Seattle.
What if one will be really unpopular? No one will go to the game. The NBA does not need Seattle. There's always going to be a city that's going to want a team, whether it's a city that loses a team to Seattle or whether it's another city. Like Louisville never comes up in these conversations. They are desperate to get an NBA team. They have a whole committee and everything. Dan Issel is the face of it.
But it's still, it's Louisville.
It is.
This is not Los Angeles, right? Like,
but there's always going to be
difference.
A place that
there's
wants a
city. There's always going to be a city who wants basically everything.
There's always going to be a Shelbyville, and they're going to get that monorail if we don't get the monorail.
So the question that was coming up among Sonics fans or Seattleites was, do we even want a team if Robert Sarver is the owner? And to me, the answer to this question is so obvious. And teams last longer than owners do.
Bingo.
Which, you know, in the modern climate of professional sports franchises, especially basketball teams, like there are not that many basketball teams that are for sale right now. It's not easy to get in. Like, the ownership groups are going to last longer than they ever have in the past. And it seems like that's a trend that's probably going to continue. Robert Sarver doesn't want to give up this asset that he has.
No.
Unless he's getting paid very royally for it. So it could mean, let's say that this hypothetical scenario plays out. You could see a situation with Robert Sarver owning the team in Seattle. But again, professional sports franchise... professional sports franchises, I'm going to knock on wood when I'm saying this, most of the time outlast their ownership groups.
I mean, my quote when someone mentions something like this to me was from the Jay-Z, the Paris, the Nets could go 0-82 and I'd look at you like this shit's gravy. Like, just having an NBA team, having the Sonics back, nothing else matters. They could lose every game. It would still be better than not having a team.
Yeah, yeah. I don't care who the owner is, right? Like, it really doesn't matter. And there's no way, there's nothing that's similar to the feeling of paying attention to a team every single day, to the feeling of hope that you get with a bad team in the draft lottery, to the feeling of just, like, watching young players develop, even if the team is bad.
I think the other thing that's probably worth considering here, though, is we talk about the fact that it would be Sarver moving the team if many, many, many steps happen and this were to come to pass. That, I think, then becomes more of a challenge at a renovated Key Arena, where, as we've talked about in the past, you're sharing revenue with the hockey ownership group and with Oakview Group, which now is putting up north of $800 million to build this arena and has to get the enough money out of it generated from operations to pay for this huge investment. So is there enough of a pie left over that the team is more valuable in Seattle than it would be in Phoenix or in Las Vegas? I think that's an open question mark. And that's where it'd probably be an easier sell if, you know, it was an NBA-only arena that he was able to buy into much more heavily.
Uh-huh.
That being in Soto, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe there's an arena that could do that.
If only there were plans for it and land and everything.
But, I mean, as you've discussed, that's not dead.
No.
Right?
It is not.
I mean, that's the positive situation that we're in, is when there is a team that's ready to move, the chances of somebody in Seattle figuring out an arena for that team seem pretty high.
The more options you have, the better your chances of getting an NBA team.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, this is very interesting. Again, I mean, you know, we're obviously going to be monitoring the situation closely. I do think that the only realistic way for this to happen to me is just that same thing. Like,
brinksmanship?
Yeah. I think people just getting farther along than they want to. And then eventually being like, fuck it, we have to do this now.
But that happens. I mean, that happened. Or getting offended. Like, that's what happened with Howard Schultz. Like, he was offended by the way he was treated by local politicians. And, well, fortunately for the Suns, they don't have to go through the state legislature, which is a major obstacle for the Sonics. That, you know,
this is still, it's still a different situation, though. Like, I'm rolling my eyes at your Howard Schultz got offended. Howard Schultz got offended, so he decided to sell the team to somebody who is clearly going to try to move the team. If Robert Sarver all of a sudden sells the Suns tomorrow to a group from Seattle, then you start being nervous if you're in Phoenix. But it is a very different situation.
Let it get to that point because, as I said on Twitter, like in Seattle, politicians were like, this isn't going to happen, this isn't going to happen, you're not going to move the team, right up until the minute they sold the team to the group from Oklahoma City. And by that point, it was surely already too late.
Well, I was going to say.
They also should maybe try.
Hopefully Robert Sarver is a better person than Howard Schultz is and has a better read of the situation.
I think Howard Schultz honestly believed that having the leverage of potentially moving the team would help facilitate the process of Gideon Arena. I believe that.
Interesting. but do you think, here's another random question, which you probably wouldn't have enough info to know the answer to. When people see this, do you think that they're like, yes, Sarver is definitely owning the team, it's not even worth inquiring? Or are potential owners from Seattle reaching out and being like, are you interested in selling the team?
I'm sure people would reach out to make that ask. I think it's also possible that they could talk to Sarver about the possibility of moving the team to play in an arena here while he continues to own it.
Okay.
I think that could happen.
Interesting. Well, we will definitely be monitoring the situation closely. Is there anything else? So we're talking Phoenix to Seattle. Are there still any other arena situations around the league that we should really be paying attention to?
I mean, Memphis still is a long-term possibility. New Orleans still a long-term possibility. But there's nothing changing on those fronts right now.
They all feel like Phoenix is a similarly sized market to Seattle. You know, they have more professional sports teams. I mean, now that everybody has more professional sports teams than Seattle.
No. I mean, depends how you count the Sounders. They don't have an MLS team.
Well, now that the Sounders have hockey.
Seattle
has hockey awarded. Now they're tied with Phoenix.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, Phoenix definitely may have more franchises than it really needs for its size, which is a possible concern for Seattle if both the NHL and the NBA come here, but we'll worry about that when it comes.
Seattle can support every single sports franchise. Oh,
the XFL. They're supporting the XFL.
There we go.
Toast to the expansion XFL franchise. That's the only time we're going to mention them for a long period of time. Speaking of hockey, Oakview Group's Steve Mattson was on a Seattle Channel special about the NHL awarding Seattle an expansion team last week and said that the team name will be, quote, water-related. That rules out, seemingly, the Metropolitans, Rainiers, and Totems, among other names whose web domains were registered by the group connected to, the lawyer for OVG last year. The remaining possibilities from that list, the Kraken, the Sea Lions, the Seals, Sockeyes, plus perhaps Steelheads, which was not in that list, and or maybe I've got it backwards. I think Steelheads was on the list, but Sockeyes wasn't, and the Whales.
Whales?
That seems unlikely.
Such a stupid name.
I would be against that.
It's also so similar to the Whalers, right?
That is an issue with it, yes.
Sea Lions and Seals, this is some... What is the term here? Pelton Cast zoology?
Oh, no.
Those are the same thing, right?
No. What are you teaching your children here? I saw one of them playing in the Duwamish River as I was running along at the
end. Really?
It was very stunning.
Wow. This is big news.
I do not know whether it was a seal or a sea lion. No,
you should have been.
I know they're different, but I don't know which one.
Running the Duwamish River, there should have been a Dix there right next to you, the Boulevard Park Dix.
Yes.
Chomping down, yes, watching a seal and or sea lion. But it doesn't matter because they're the same thing.
I think I'm on the record. I want either Sockeyes or Steelheads. But my main thing I'm on the record is just not a name with a singular instead of a plural. So that seems to perhaps rule out Kraken.
R.I.P. to the Totems. How are you going to name a team the Rainiers also? Like, why would that even be in the consideration? There's already another team named the Rainiers.
Yeah. There's already other teams named the Metropolitans, if we're going to get technical here. But not here, I guess.
Not in Seattle.
True. I mean, Tacoma is not Seattle, but I know what you're saying.
RIP to Totems, though.
Yeah.
We gave it our best shot.
I mean, it would have been too confusing. Who would have known which Totems you were talking about yeah. when you said, this is Totems country? I mentioned earlier the Mariners lease, which proved contentious with the King County Council over the summer. That process has finally come to a conclusion this week, with the Public Facilities District that oversees what was known as Safeco Field approving the new lease by a 7-0 vote that clears the path for the Mariners to announce a new sponsorship deal for their stadium.
They were waiting to announce that.
Yes.
Because of this vote.
Which has been previously reported will be T-Mobile sponsoring what was Safeco Field. An update on the Sounders for the first time in a couple of weeks, where we've got some news off the pitch in terms of contracts. Paul Tenorio of The Athletic reported that Jordan Morris has signed a new contract for up to 5 years, including 3 guaranteed years plus 2 team options, that could average $1 million if he plays the duration of the contract. Morris was entering the last year of the contract he signed with the Sounders as a homegrown player when he debuted in MLS. Tenorio also reported that Christian Roldan is in extension negotiations, and Sounder at Heart subsequently reported that the two sides have agreed in principle and are finalizing details of a new contract. Both players will likely to be bought down to the maximum player charge at some point, at least during the contract, using targeted allocation money. Then Jeff Baker also reported that both deals are unlikely to be announced until 2019. We will not accept either of those as bold predictions for 2019.
What do you mean?
Like, you can't say Jordan Morris will sign a contract extension.
Oh, God. Who would try to do that? That wouldn't be bold.
I know.
The predictions have to be bold here.
I agree.
All right. So you're making rules about things that neither of us would try to do.
And you just got to put that out
there.
That's
like saying we're not going to accept Top Ramen as part of the ramen bracket. It's like, I know. Of course.
It's a funny joke sometimes, though. We're just going to post it on Instagram. Sounder at Heart also reported last week that Brian Schmetzer signed a contract extension last year that was not announced at the time at his request. So some evidence that perhaps Schmetzer's job was safer during the 2018 season than we thought when the Sounders were struggling early in the schedule.
The Roldan and Morris signings, Jordan Morris is almost like an unknown quantity at this point.
Yeah, and so part of the logic here is, if he comes back and has a big season, then perhaps he could go elsewhere, get a big contract, and I think that's part of what they're trying to stave off with this extension.
And we also definitely learned at the end of last year that Christian Roldan is hugely important.
Yeah.
But also,
I think... Not that there was any question about
this
that.
This is not Sounder news, but a toast is definitely in order to Atlanta FC.
Atlanta United?
Atlanta United FC.
For defeating the Timbers 2-0 in the MLS Cup, thus keeping the Sounders and Timbers tied at one win and one loss.
It was close.
In the MLS Cup.
It was close there.
I was watching this game in Portland at the Blazers game on Saturday night. It would have been rough if the Timbers had won while I was in Portland.
That wouldn't have been good for anybody.
Yeah, so thanks to Atlanta United for preventing that from happening.
Shockingly, the Blazers managed to win that game, right?
That is accurate.
It's funny that I'm toasting to the other team from Portland for losing, but then upset about the Blazers for losing.
Mixed emotions. When you meet people who root for the Timbers, Blazers, and Oregon and the Seahawks, you really just don't know what to think. UW men's basketball, last week we gave them virtually no chance of winning at Gonzaga. They almost did it. They teased us with pulling off what would have been the third huge upset of the Mike Hopkins era, following a win in Kansas City against Kansas and a win at home against Arizona. But eventually, Rui Hachimura untied the game in the closing seconds and gave Gonzaga an 81-79 win, number one Gonzaga, an 81-79 win to stay undefeated for like 3 more days before they lost to Tennessee.
Oh, this game. I mean, really, when you look at it, like, yes, going into Kansas City and beating Kansas, it's very shocking. The game against Arizona at home, much less shocking, right? Those games happen a lot. Like,
yeah,
that happens. Going into the number one team in the country, arguably your biggest rival in the world, and beating them in their house.
I like that you said the world, as if it's actually some team in the Chinese basketball league, CBA, is the Huskies' biggest rival.
I'm just putting the stakes higher.
Okay.
Right?
Because, there's no love lost between the Huskies and Barcelona.
If I would have been, like, arguably your greatest rival in the tri-state area.
That's Washington, Oregon, and Idaho.
Yeah, of course, everybody knows that's the tri-state area. Damn it. Anyway, I was just making the stakes bigger with their biggest rival in the universe.
No love lost between the Huskies and Mars. Some love lost between Steph Curry and the moon landing.
Wait, what? Oh, wait, Steph Curry thinks it's faked?
No, he was joking.
Oh.
We've moved on.
Okay. This
okay. Life comes at you fast on the internet.
This would have been huge. I mean, this would have been like... It would have been... Lorenzo Romar had some very big wins and stages that mattered a lot. But it would have given Mike Hopkins a defining victory of his tenure as a Husky head coach. And honestly, the stakes for it are pretty high because giving them, they don't have a signature victory right now. We've talked about this where their best win is over not Minnesota, right? Minnesota?
Who's the team? They didn't
beat Minnesota. They beat one of the teams, lost one of the other teams.
Yeah, I've already forgotten who it was the other major. Texas A&M.
You can tell me like who the Mariners played on July 12th, 1994, but...
I believe it was Texas A&M.
I believe it was the Chicago White Sox. Harold Baines had a hell of a game. This would have...
That's Hall of Famer Harold Baines to you, good sir.
This would have put them on track, given them that signature victory, and it would have put us in a much better position to be going to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, the ridiculousness of it all was that they had a last second shot to win, and it's just the game doesn't matter. Right? I mean, it's just a loss.
Well, yeah. I mean, first off, I don't know how many people on the East Coast were actually watching this game. At what was it? Was that an 8 p.m. tip or a 7 p.m. tip? But very late Eastern time, either way. Also, some of the good vibes from this performance dissipated. On Sunday, the Huskies were up 20 early in the second half against another in-state rival, Seattle U, the in-city rival.
Their biggest rival in the entire city of Seattle.
That's accurate. SPU doesn't even come close.
Yeah.
Then Seattle U closed at one point in the late stages of this game to within two.
Oh, no.
Before the Huskies pulled away to complete the 70-62 victory. And I've got something to confess on this podcast.
Okay.
It was 100% my fault.
Oh.
Because I left early to go watch the end of the Rams-Bears game and eat dinner.
Wow. And,
like, I left, I think it was still 15 at the point that I left, at the under 8 timeout. And by the time I got back to my car, it was already down to, like, 7.
Yeah. No, I like that.
Yeah, it was my fault.
Yeah, I agree every time you take responsibility for things happening.
Negative things happening. You take responsibility for all positive things happening. I take responsibility for all the negative things.
What positive things am I taking responsibility for?
The last 4 weeks of Seahawks games.
They have been pretty positive, haven't they? To me, the defining thing that happened in this Gonzaga game, and it looked like it held true also against Seattle U, was I think that, and maybe this has to do with Noah Dickerson's injury or whatever, Jalen Noel is kind of finally stepping up and being the real heart of the Husky offense.
I mean, I don't know if they would say finally. Like, his ability to make plays down the stretch was really invaluable for last year's Huskies, particularly in their non-conference games that were closer than they probably should have.
Noel's.
But yes, I forgot about the Noel.
The game that he played offensively against Gonzaga was an unbelievable game, and he was the only player who could really create for the Huskies down the stretch.
Yeah. I mean, he's excellent in those situations. And, you know, the Huskies, I think, in part because of the fact that he's not necessarily, and he did have 6 assists against Gonzaga, but he's not the most natural playmaker, and, you know, they're not getting that much from David Crisp as a playmaker. They sometimes have a tendency to bog down in isolations, but when it's him doing it, those can be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he's been a consistent presence, you know. He had a rough game against Eastern, but just because of the fact that he didn't, but they didn't need him against Eastern. He had 7 assists. He didn't score that much, but every other game this season has at least 14 points.
So what about this week as we kind of close in toward the end of the college basketball preseason?
So for the second consecutive year, the Huskies will be facing Virginia Tech on the East Coast after playing last year at MSG as part of the 2K Classic. Virginia Tech won that game 103-79 behind 15 of 22 three-point shooting against a nascent Mike Hopkins zone. Virginia Tech went on to lose in the first round of last year's NCAA tournament to Alabama as an 8 seed. They are off to a better start even this year, 8-1 with their lone loss at Penn State, won the Charleston Classic, beating Purdue in the final of that tournament. They're led by sophomore guard Nikhil Alexander-Walker, a likely NBA first-round pick. He's the cousin of his fellow Canadian Shea Gilgeous-Alexander of the Clippers, and is averaging 17.7 points and shooting 46% on threes so far this season. Also in the backcourt, Justin Robinson is averaging 15 points and 6 assists and shooting 42% on threes. Virginia Tech makes 45% of its threes as a team and are second in the country in effective field goal percentage. Defensively, they're second in forcing turnovers and at keeping opponents off the free throw line. They do, however, allow a ton of three-pointers, 46% of their opponent attempts, putting them in the NCAA's top 25. So the Huskies are probably going to have to shoot the ball well from downtown, as they haven't much of this season.
Great news.
To win this game.
I mean, from your description here, this is just set up to be a horrible game for the Huskies.
It's not an ideal matchup. Maybe just stop scheduling Virginia Tech, especially on the East Coast. Like, if they want to fly all the way to Seattle or even, like play in L.A. or something. But, like, Atlantic City and New York, these are not the most neutral of sites in terms of travel.
But I'll tell you what, you throw out the records when you get to the Atlantic City Boardwalk Classic.
You do. This is the inaugural Atlantic City Boardwalk Classic.
Oh, well.
So I guess you do throw out the records. Because
at least the records in the Atlantic City Boardwalk Classic.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, this is the Huskies' last chance to beat, to get like a more that signature non-conference win that you were talking about. They're probably not going to have many opportunities in Pac-12 play to do that because the Pac-12
again, because they're not non-conference.
Sucks.
I mean, okay, best case scenario is they lose. Well, not best case scenario if they win this game is they have the signature win, right?
Yeah.
Best case scenario if they lose this game is that they pretty much have to dominate the Pac-12 because it's not going to be a five-team bid conference, right?
No, it might be like a two-bid conference.
So they need to kind of dominate the conference at that point.
Yeah, they definitely do.
We're screwed. We're not going to the NCAA tournament ever.
If you can't do it when you're starting this many seniors, it's probably a bad sign for your ability
I hate to compare anything to the Mariners, but this is kind of the Mariners season, right? Like, after this year, there's not a lot left. There's some sort of promising young players, but you're talking about losing Noah Dickerson, Matisse Thybulle, David Crisp, thank God. Sorry, David Crisp. Possibly Jalen Noel.
Eh. I don't think that's that likely.
Still a chance.
I think you'll have Jalen Noel in the sophomore class. Nas Carter and Hamir Wright. That's your core next year. I mean, and that's a fine core, but there's just not probably enough supporting talent. And it's a bummer. The freshmen keep getting injured. We already had Elijah Hardy sidelined, and then Brian Penn Johnson suffered an injury last week, and he's now out 6 to 8 weeks. So
it's going to be like 10 years before they make the NCAA tournament. Who do you think will be the coach when they make the NCAA tournament? Will it be Mike Hopkins?
I think so.
Okay.
Oh, no. How quickly you've turned. Well, the other UW basketball team, a signature home victory last week on Wednesday against Ohio State, beating their former coach, Kevin McGough, and the Buckeyes, who granted are not the same team that won the Big Ten, both regular season and tournament last year, because they lost several seniors. But nonetheless, an impressive victory for Jody Wynn's crew in her second season, running their record now to 6-3 and 4-0 at Heck Edmondson Pavilion. The Huskies will host the Husky Classic this Saturday, Sunday, facing Montana in the opener, and then either St. Francis or Boise State in the second game, depending on the outcomes.
And everybody knows that you throw out the records when you get to the Husky Classic.
Most likely it'll be the Huskies against Boise State.
Bring on St. Francis! Here.
Montana 4-3 and coming off a 49-point loss at Arizona last week. Arizona's playing very well under
49-point loss
under former UW assistant and Storm player Adia Barnes.
Oh, she's the head coach there.
Yeah, and Arian McDonald, who transferred from UW after Mike Nabors left, she's one of the leading scorers in the country now.
Cool.
That's great. Boise State is 6-2, but one of those two losses came by 24 at Wazoo. So Huskies should be healthy favorites to win their namesake tournament on their home floor. UW women's volleyball saw their season come to an end in the NCAA tournament Sweet 16, where they were swept by Penn State, ending their kind of surprising run after pulling off the upset of Omaha in Creighton. Creighton in Omaha, I should say. So disappointing there, but nonetheless a good run by UW Volleyball to get back to the NCAA tournament for the fifth time in the last 6 years, or to the Sweet 16, I should say, for the fifth time in the last 6 years. On the UW football front, closing out the UW section here, the Huskies swept the Pac-12's Morris trophies, with Caleb McGarry winning for the offensive line and Greg Gaines winning for the defensive line. That award is voted on by the opposing linemen in the conference. The defensive linemen vote on the who's the best offensive lineman they played, and vice versa. So it's kind of a cool award that, you know, yeah, you're getting recognition by your peers. Gaines follows Vita Vea is the second consecutive UW winner of the defensive line Morris Trophy.
And when it's, I mean, honestly, it's a little bit surprising to see in some ways a Husky defense that definitely picked it up the last couple of weeks. But and we kind of documented some of their pass rush issues throughout the year.
But those weren't Greg Gaines's fault.
Probably
not everyone can be,
fault.
You know, Vita Vea and Danny Shelton and both be a run-stopping defensive lineman and also get to the quarterback constantly.
Hey, Greg Gaines, he had some whacks on people.
I'm not saying he didn't, but he's not a one-man pass rush.
And Caleb McGarry, you basically never heard his name.
Which is probably a good thing as an offensive lineman.
But I think it's a cool thing for him to win.
Yeah. Ben Burke-Irving getting a lot of All-America picks. Sidney Jones and Taylor Rapp getting slightly fewer, but...
Let's not say Sidney Jones around here.
Wait, did I say that?
It was not a good week for Sidney Jones.
It was not a good week for Sidney Jones.
I think you mean Byron Murphy.
I do mean Byron Murphy.
Who is not the next Sidney Jones. Sidney Jones would have been a great NFL player had he not been injured.
A ruptured Achilles is a very difficult injury to come back from.
This is not Sidney Jones' fault.
We wrap up with the Seahawks coming off their thrilling Monday Night Football win over the Minnesota Vikings. We recapped all of that action on a special Pelton cast. If you haven't listened to that already, it's great fun. So you should definitely check that out. The Seahawks now, for the second time in 3 weeks, we'll face the San Francisco 49ers with a chance to clinch a playoff berth by winning in Santa Clara.
We kind of talked about the stakes for this game already on the recap pod, right? Going to the playoffs is huge. You know, back in the day when the Seahawks were able to do these sort of things, we would kind of look at the tiers of like goal number one, make the playoffs. Goal number two, win the division. Goal number three, get a bye in the first round. Goal number four, number one seed, home field throughout. Everything that's available to the Seahawks is just goal number one.
I mean, five seed versus six seed matters, but yes.
Even like, okay, yeah, I suppose we can add a fifth tier for that. Make the playoffs, get the five
seed.
I mean,
if you're going to put the one seed as its own tier relative to bye, then I
think... The one seed is a huge...
Every time
the Seahawks have been the one seed, they've gone to the Super Bowl.
Fine.
But
a lot of those things go off the table in a hurry when you don't win the division. You can't do any of the other things. Like, the Seahawks could theoretically end up with one of the three best records in the NFC, probably.
Those were high-class goals to have.
Yeah.
The Seahawks could end up with one of the three best records in the NFC.
Let me check that out.
You...
I mean, they could finish... They can finish 11-5. Yeah, I mean, at this point, no one in the NFC has clinched a better record than the Seahawks. They just lose the tiebreaker to the Rams.
Where did this confidence come from?
I'm just saying hypothetically.
Okay.
And you're listing goals.
Okay.
The Chiefs, I mean, the Chiefs could have everything locked up next week.
Everything locked up?
Yeah, they could have the one seed locked up. If
really?
They win and the Patriots lose, they will clinch the number one seed in the AFC. The odds of that, if you go by the lines this week, are about 30%. It's definitely realistic. The odds of the Seahawks having everything clinched is the number five seed, which would require them to win and the Vikings to lose, about 17%.
And who do the Vikings play?
They host Miami.
Huh. Miami, it's such a hard team to read.
You never know when they're going to pull a miraculous play on the last end of the game.
So we kind of talked about those stakes. Those are high-class problems to have, right? But so now basically what the Seahawks have available to them is make the playoffs, and then you're just like, okay, here we are.
It is interesting that because of the way that the gap between the best team in the NFC West being so much better than them and the Rams, and the other NFC wildcard teams at this point being so much worse for them, that you could be locked into the five seed with 2 weeks left to go. That's a relatively unusual situation.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the NFL in general has a lot of kind of strange situations playoff-wise this year. Not strange, but just a lot of situations where there might not be... I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, because let's just win a game.
Yeah.
But there might not be that much drama, particularly in the NFC playoffs.
Yes. In terms of the races.
But definitely some news from throughout the Seahawks this last week.
A lot of injury updates since we did the recap podcast. Most notably, the news that Michael Kendricks has been lost to a season-ending tibia fracture that will require surgery.
What in the hell?
So Pete Carroll first kind of hinted at this on his interview on ESPN 710 on Monday morning, where he said that Kendricks had played through an injury in the second half. Didn't realize it was this serious. Kendricks, who returned to the lineup for the first time since his NFL suspension for insider trading, played 76% of snaps. Austin Calitro, who had been starting at weak side linebacker, played just one snap in the game.
Yeah, and, you know, like, I mean, we've kind of talked about this. The Seahawks played one of their better defensive games of the year, at least the later year in that. And the thing that you have, like, could we tell the difference between Austin Calitro and Michael Kendricks from a fan perspective? Maybe not. But the team only playing Austin Calitro one snap means that it's clear to them who's better.
Yes. So at some point, KJ Wright is going to return and retake that position. He was able to participate in the Seahawks walkthrough on Wednesday, but Pete Carroll said he's still not expected to play this week. So probably it'll be Calitro in that spot once more. Doug Baldwin is day-to-day after sitting out Monday night, where we certainly saw his value and how much he was missed with his route running and ability to create separation against a Vikings secondary that largely shut down the Seahawks play action game. DJ Fluker sounds doubtful for the game. Jordan Simmons will continue. He's played well in his couple of starts so far in place of DJ Fluker.
Yeah, I mean, the timing with KJ is pretty nice. Having this, God, they just need to win on Sunday, though. And ease back KJ. I think they should play him, right? Let's say that they
if he's healthy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least week 16, week 17. They should give KJ some snaps. Get him in their game speed, stuff like that. Prepare for the playoffs.
You might be able to rest Doug Baldwin at that point and try to get him as close to 100% health as he's going to get to at this point.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I have a semi-serious Seahawks question for you.
Okay.
So look, we're all celebrating. We're all watching Cable Thanos videos. Like, there's this notion that everyone who didn't think the Seahawks was going to make the playoffs this season was horribly wrong.
Uh-huh.
Because they overwhelmingly are likely to make the playoffs now. If you hold that opinion, doesn't it mean that you feel like last year's Seahawks team wildly underachieved? Like, all the credit, Pete Carroll, like, this is one of his best coaching jobs ever, which, you know what? When he won the Super Bowl, that was probably a pretty damn good coaching job, quite frankly. Like, there's sometimes, like, that hipster contrarian thing of, like, oh, the year where they didn't win as many games was actually a better coaching job. Like, no, probably it wasn't. But,
I mean, we're the people who think the 2012 Seahawks team was the best team in NFL history.
That is the contrarian take.
Yes.
Just the best team of this run.
Yeah.
Probably we, like the 85
we know
Bears
that if Pete doesn't ice the kicker in Atlanta, that they're going to the Super Bowl 3 years in a row.
I don't winning blame icing the kicker in Atlanta for that.
You know, I'm not saying that he did anything wrong, but if he doesn't, that field goal's missed, and
yeah,
they win the Super Bowl 2 years in a row, and then it's canceled the following year. So
weird. Because so last year's Seahawks team undoubtedly, unquestionably had more talent at the skill positions. They had a better wide receiver core. They had Paul Richardson with this year's group. Doug Baldwin was healthy.
Okay.
I mean, look, Tyler Lockett has been much better, but
yes.
Still.
Tyler Lockett
there's a lot of passes to Jerron Brown and David Moore right now. A lot of passes. They had
First of all, how dare you?
They undoubtedly had more talent at tight end.
Okay.
They had Jimmy freaking Graham. He caught every
Jimmy
touchdown.
Graham sucks.
He might suck, but he caught every single touchdown last year. He caught literally all of the touchdowns. They had Richard Sherman healthy for part of the season, Earl Thomas healthy for more of the season than he was this year, and yet that team was worse by every single statistical measure. So didn't they wildly underachieve last year if this is actually how good they have been all along?
I don't really understand what your question is. Did they underachieve last year?
Well, just like if you think that people were crazy to think the Seahawks weren't going to be that good last year, that therefore implies that they had this much talent on the roster, like a similar amount of talent on the roster last year.
I think you're they had all these players. That was the beginning of the season. And part of what made them so much worse was how bad they finished the year.
True. But still, were they at any point, plus 74 in point differential? I mean, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I don't think they were. I mean, I guess the Rams game did take them down a significant amount, so maybe they were, in fact, plus 74. But the Rams game still happened.
They did beat the eventual Super Bowl champions, on Monday Night Football.
It is true, but they were by no measure one of the six best teams in the conference last year.
There was definitely some luck stuff that they didn't have going for them last year also.
In terms of Blair Walsh misses?
In terms of Blair Walsh misses, lucky Washington passes. I mean, I don't know. I think that they're probably...
I mean, the same point differential last year as the Lions.
What was it?
Plus 34.
That's not that bad, though. The Lions were much better last year than they are this year.
They're still the Lions.
Why can't I find the individual stats on Football Outsiders?
I can't answer that.
I want statistical evidence of how much Jimmy Graham sucks.
It wasn't a great season for Jimmy Graham.
Is he out? Is he done for the year?
I mean, Jimmy Graham was above replacement by DR last year.
There we go. That's all you can ask for.
Look, they can't measure touchdowns.
How much above replacement was Will Disley? I don't think I understand the basis of your question.
It's just this very self-congratulatory tone of Seahawks Twitter. Look, the people who said, oh, the Seahawks are going to be in the mix for the number one pick, that was never supported unless Russell Wilson was injured. But the idea that they were going to be 8-8 or 9-7, I still don't think was actually that far off.
The team has been slightly better than we expected.
Yeah.
They've been better than we expected. And the situation with the offense has been better. Although at the same time, if you listen to our conversations, just removing Tom Cable gave us some confidence.
I mean, that's ultimately the take, is that last year's team failed in large part because the offensive line was so bad, and that falls on Tom Cable.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You have a full year of Dwayne Brown. Just the offensive line personnel-wise this year looks better.
Yeah.
Right?
But it's still largely the same personnel. So I think Mike Solari deserves a lot of credit.
No, Mike Solari definitely deserves a lot of credit. I mean, Tom Cable, him being there at all is such a net negative and making the team worse. And also the game plan that they had, which is not all that dissimilar from what they're doing this year. They're just, because of the success of doing it, are able to run the ball even more. They're able to run the ball exactly as much as Pete Carroll would like. With his complicated rules. But they were still running the ball way too much and were terrible at it. So if you give this team the offense that they want to run, an average run game, which is what has happened, then they're able to do everything else that much better. Russell Wilson has been a better quarterback this year than he was last year.
He has. Yeah.
So, and that's part of why we thought these people were ridiculous, is you're talking about a team where... they still have Russell fucking Wilson, right? Yeah. Russell damn Wilson. That's why these people who said they would have the number one pick in the draft,
it was not only bad results, but it was also a bad process.
This motherfuckers act like they forgot about Trey, right? That's what was happening in the situation. There were teams that were going into the season with Ryan Tannehill as their starting quarterback.
I mean, that team actually could make the playoffs.
I
would have gone with Sam Bradford and Josh Rosen. I would have gone with Josh McCown Sam Darnold.
Five rookie starting quarterbacks.
I would have gone with Josh Allen.
There are teams, think about this. There are teams
pretty much anyone named Josh.
With Josh Allen as their starting quarterback, Eli Manning as their starting quarterback, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, all of these players, and these people on the internet were saying that the Seahawks were going to have the number one pick. It was clown talk is what was happening.
He was also trying to be everyone's going to say that the obvious bad teams are bad, but I'm going to say that an unobvious team will be bad.
You want to know what my favorite Christmas movie is? It's Die Hard. Right, they were being the snarky white guy at the party.
Die Hard has actually gone too far. Now Die Hard is the obvious Christmas movie. Yeah. It's the so underrated.
But you get what the joke
overrated.
Is, right? It's like the high school white kid or whatever who wants to make the edgy opinion. That's who all these people on the internet were, and that's why when Russell Wilson is out there having 40-yard runs, he is running it straight down their throats.
The highlight of every week now is the Cable Thanos video.
Motherfuckers act like they forgot about Dre, right? Am I wrong about this? And so, okay, we had this conversation. This was, I think, an offline conversation. And I was doing some soul searching.
I call those unrecorded podcasts.
I was doing some soul searching on Monday morning, thinking to myself, is there some sort of hidden value to running the ball? Like, is there something that the stats aren't seeing? I was listening to Brock Huard on Monday morning. Everybody,
are you talking about Tuesday morning?
Oh, this was Tuesday morning?
This is the day after the game. Was Tuesday. I think I called it Monday earlier.
It was Monday morning. I mean, it wasn't Monday morning, but it was Monday morning.
It was, yes. I don't know that the value of the running, hidden value of the running game is really shown by a game where they scored 14 points on offense.
But no. So here's what I was thinking about. And we didn't quite get there when we were talking about the Vikings game. And this is a point that I made to you that I wanted to get across, was the hidden value of the run game is having Russell Wilson. He's all that matters. The Seahawks ran the ball well against the Vikings, and their offense scored 14 points.
Because Russell Wilson didn't play well.
Because Russell Wilson didn't play well.
A single drop of rain touched him.
He had been touched by rain.
He has been contacted by rain.
But
also, did you see, by the way, the forecast for this Sunday?
Oh, no.
It's going to rain, apparently.
That's fine. It's a bigger issue in Seattle, right, when it rains? Or it just doesn't rain other places all that often?
It probably doesn't rain all the other places that often. I have not double-checked all the weather, the history of weather for every other place that Seattle's
has
played.
Meteorology. We did that. We have to go into Tasteful Profanity to do that.
Exactly.
But what I'm saying is that when Russell Wilson plays well, the offense is amazing. The run game is just, it's literally nothing, right? It means nothing. If Russell Wilson plays well, the offense scores points. If Russell Wilson doesn't play well, or at least doesn't
pass
the ball,
it means something, because it means whether they can run play action or not.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean whether they can run play action.
I'm sorry, they will.
And we've talked about this extensively. It means whether they will run play action.
Okay, it does look like the latest update suggests those showers might hold off until after 4 o'clock. So perhaps the Seahawks will be okay.
We're making the playoffs, baby. But you understand what I'm saying. There is no hidden value to running the ball. These people just don't get it. I would love to see Brock Huard watch this offense, right? And I don't know why I'm calling out Brock Huard, because he was talking more shit about the defense. But I would love to see these people who are obsessed with the run game see Josh Allen as the quarterback.
I mean, Josh Allen, the run game would be pretty amazing with Josh Allen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
sure.
He's sure it would. He's like a young Russell Wilson without the passing. His stats are shockingly similar to Tim Tebow's. I don't know if you've done that comparison. Shockingly.
But you can take 15 quarterbacks from throughout the league, right? Have this exact same run game, put those quarterbacks into the system, and this is the 20th best offense in the NFL.
Yeah.
And right now they rank
ninth.
It is because of Russell Wilson. You know, like, I don't know if you can do that exercise. You probably could do that exercise and put in a replacement-level quarterback.
Probably could, yeah.
And it is...
I mean, they already rank lower in overall DVOA than they do in either rushing or passing DVOA.
Yes,
because of the fact that their ratio of runs to pass, it's what we talked about, the Cougars. Simpsons paradox.
So, anyway, what I was saying, I did that soul-searching, and I came out on the other side, and my soul looked the same.
You're through the looking glass. Wow.
All that matters is Russell Wilson. These people don't get it. The defense matters.
Yes.
And the defense has been, we constantly were ranking where we thought the teams would be. So we need to find the one definitive one, right?
Yes.
Because we did this like four times throughout the, I think there was a recap pod that we did right after last year where we talked about where the team would rank this year. One of them we have to determine is the definitive one and then judge the quality of how people have done.
Well, we'll look at which was the most accurate and determine based on that. I think we did it after the coordinator changes because we were trying to set a fair baseline for the new coordinators.
Yes. But all that matters here is Russell Wilson. The run game is just, it's fluff, more or less.
Should we talk about the 49ers?
Again.
So they're in some ways a different team than we faced 2 weeks ago because in the interim, the 2-10 49ers took down these surging top 10 in DVOA, making a late playoff push, Denver Broncos at home last weekend. And that came with with Nick Mullins after throwing for 414 yards against the Seahawks. I don't know why Brock Heward. Yeah, he did not throw for any yards. Tied for the ninth most ever against the Seahawks 2 weeks ago. Last week was even better in terms of yards per attempt at 10.1 yards per attempt. Of course, about a quarter of his yard did come on an 85-yard touchdown pass to George Kittle, which was very valuable to me in my fantasy teams, since I have George Kittle on both of them. Kittle had 210 yards on 9 targets, falling 5 yards short of the single-game record for a tight end.
Oh, so close.
Kyle Shanahan, after the game, lamenting to him, or possibly even on the sideline during the game, lamenting to him that he didn't get him those extra 5 yards, because he had all 210 came in the first half of that game.
He didn't gain a yard in the second half?
Didn't have a catch.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, they were running the ball a lot because they were ahead at that point. The other leading target for the 49ers last week, and coming off his pair of touchdowns in Seattle, Dante Pettis scored a touchdown for the third consecutive game.
Dante's frightening.
His 7 targets were most among Niners wide receivers, as Shanahan said that they are really looking to emphasize their young players at wide receiver.
Over who? Pierre Garçon's on IR.
Well, yes.
Like, what are they going to do? They're not signing Brandon Marshall and playing him? They only have young players.
Well, they have either Godwin or Goodwin, but I can't remember which of those is in Tampa Bay.
Marquise Goodwin. Godwin is in Tampa Bay. You don't know this? Wow.
Not off the top of my head.
Jesus.
I know it's one of the two.
I've had Chris Godwin on my fantasy team all season. I don't think I've played him once.
So he missed 2 games, including the game in Seattle, for personal reasons. Was back last week, but did not play as much as Pettis.
Also, Dante Pettis is amazing.
He's getting better each week. He's a playmaker. They got to let him return punts. Inexplicably, they did not let him return punts last weekend, after the fumbled punt in Seattle. But maybe wait until week 16 to do that.
He's the greatest punt returner in all of college football history, but couldn't return punts for the 49ers.
Jeff Wilson got the start at running back last week in 23 of the 25 carries for running backs by San Francisco, with Matt Breida sidelined by the ankle injury that he exacerbated in Seattle. Breida, a question mark. He could be back this weekend. Will probably be limited if he is, so we'll probably still see a lot of Jeff Wilson.
Jeff Wilson's playing well, right?
Well, he's been right around 4 yards per carry, and he has fumbled in each of the last 2 games, so he's not playing that well.
But the receiving yards in Seattle.
Yeah, he was very effective out of the backfield. Something the Niners do well.
I see no reason to play Matt Breida.
Is it Matt Breida owner?
I think I'm starting Jeff Wilson.
Are you?
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah, I'm starting Jeff Wilson.
Let's see if Matt Breida plays first. Actually, perhaps the bigger story, we talked about Nick Mullins, and I mean, George Kittle obviously is the biggest story of the Niners' win over the Broncos, but the most surprising aspect of that game was how dominant their defense was against Denver. You saw the Seahawks just torch their secondary, specifically Akello Witherspoon across from Richard Sherman, for 10.9 yards per attempt and 4 touchdowns on 17 pass attempts 2 weeks ago. But Case Keenum had 1 more passing yard than Wilson on 25 more pass attempts, averaging 4.4 yards per attempt. Is the Niners' defense good now?
I know. It's really hard to tell.
Did they just get lucky? Denver, so they were light on receiving weapons. Emmanuel Sanders, of course, got injured. They've already traded Demaryius Thomas. They didn't have much in the way of proven receivers against the San Francisco secondary, but they just couldn't get anything
going. And Jeff Huerman also being out.
You can't win without Jeff Huerman. Jake Butt has been actually surprisingly bad this year. That's this week's Broncos talk.
Bronc talk.
Broncos Wednesday. A Broncos podcast on a Wednesday.
It's hard to tell. But their defense, definitely, there were a lot of moments. We were both monitoring this game very closely because of fantasy.
Yes. And, I mean, I guess there were a lot of games going on, but this was on a lot on Red Zone.
There were a lot of moments where it seemed like the Broncos were going to get all the way back in it, and the 49ers kind of just kept coming up with stops.
Yeah.
I think having Doug Baldwin back in this game will be a pretty big deal if they can get him back on the field.
I agree. I mean, the other question is how much they can run play action, because, you know, when they only throw the ball 17 times, that means like half of your passes are play action.
Yeah.
That's great.
Again, you can run play action on every single play. all plays could be play action. In fact, really think about that. If you were a team that never did a traditional drop back, the defense would never know what was coming.
I like this. So Russell Wilson has to carry out the play fake every time he hands off to
100% of the time. Yes. Yeah, they should make the whole play out of the play action.
Okay.
I guess looking at this game,
I mean, the other thing, by the way, is the San Francisco defense also shut down Philip Lindsay. Phil Lindsay, as we're now calling it.
Yeah, Phil. He's our boy.
30 yards on 14 carries in this game. His first time this season, he was held below 3.5 yards per carry. So a big change from when the Seahawks ran for 5.8 yards per carry with both Carson and Penny over 60 rushing yards against the 49ers 2 weeks ago.
Here's the thing is, I just don't get how... I mean, we played this team 2 weeks ago. This wasn't week two, week three, right?
No.
That you could be that different of a team. Like, which is the anomaly here?
They probably just got lucky against Denver.
Yes. Or Denver's, like, has a very bad offense right now.
And also has, I mean, they had in the week between...
No Heuerman.
They lost Emmanuel Sanders and Chris Harris for the season.
Yeah. Like, I think that the onus of responsibility is like 75% Broncos bad, 25% 49ers better than people realize.
I mean, I do think offensively they're better than people realize.
Oh, yeah.
And so my expectation is, look, the first game, the Seahawks got way up early, just ran and used play action the rest of the game, and the 49ers threw for a ton of yards late, but it wasn't really that meaningful. This, I think, is much more likely to be a shootout.
You think they have to break out the good offense?
I think they might have to.
Watch out when the good offense comes out.
Oh, boy, the good offense. Loves me some good offense.
You don't break out the good offense too often.
It's like the good China.
Yeah, yeah, the good China.
It's only a fancy guest is coming over. Nick Mullins is in the house. You got to break out the good China. Nick
Mullins. Making the playoffs is in the house, right? And that's why it's just hard for me to see, you know, with the way that the Seahawks are playing and against a defense that is still a known bad.
Yes.
Right? Like, we have 13 weeks of data on the 49ers for the rest of the season and 1 week of data on them playing the Broncos.
The weird thing, by the way, about this take is they rank much better in defensively by DVOA than they do offensively. I mean, 22nd versus 27th. They're not good either way, but...
Somehow their offense is amazing, though. In the Jeff Wilson era. That's what I like to call it.
It's just the not playing Alfred Morris era.
Let me ask you a question here. If Nick Mullins was the quarterback of the Minnesota Vikings, do they score more points against the Seahawks?
100%.
Like, there's just... I
mean, yes, he has some sort of horrible interception at some point in the game. The Bobby Wagner may or may not return 98 yards for a touchdown.
There's just... Nick Mullins scares me more than Kirk Cousins
does. He's going to take shots. Kirk Cousins wasn't taking shots.
Yeah. He's like the like announcer thing. His eyes are downfield.
Even though they also have...
Free Nick Mullins, that's what I'm trying to say.
Like the very dangerous, like inside slants with Kittle and then Taylor, whose first name I do not remember.
It would be interesting if they did have to break out the good offense in this one. I'm not sure that they'll have to, but they're definitely going to give up points to this 49ers team. But again, they should be able to move the ball in this one. Having Doug back would really free up the rest of the offense. It was interesting seeing Tyler do stuff, kind of stuff that we're not used to seeing Tyler Lockett do. Also, the less Jerron Brown that's on the field, the better.
I mean, that's Jerron 2 touchdowns on 3 catches.
It's a lot better when all Jerron Brown does is score touchdowns.
I agree.
So...
Him and Jimmy Graham? He's this year's Jimmy Graham?
Yeah, he's this year's Jimmy Graham.
Okay.
You're going to tell me next year that the team has less offensive talent because they don't have Jerron Brown anymore.
That's true, because Jerron Brown is one of the greatest tight ends in NFL history.
How many years has it been?
2? He was amazing in 2016.
Okay.
Put some respect on Jimmy Graham's name.
Okay.
If he had a real quarterback this year, he'd say... Just once every podcast, gotta give that shout out to Ben B.
We've given him numerous shout outs.
No, but that particular one would be bad shout out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just don't see why this is different than 2 weeks ago.
Well, first off, it is being played on the road instead of at home. That's a difference. And second, The sure. Seahawks were probably more dominant at home than they probably should have been, all things considered. I mean, this is a game they're favored to win, but not dramatically so. The line in this game is Seahawks minus -5.
It's an arm's length game. It's not a blowout. And the that was a blowout two weeks ago.
Is it a Seahawks cornerback arm's length?
What do you mean?
Because they're like obsessed with the length of arms of their cornerbacks.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's one of those. It's the type of game that they're up by 10 for most of the game. Maybe it gets a little bit closer at another point, but they're just going to hold the 49ers back.
Well, I hope you continue to see things so clearly. I think it's going to be a little more back and forth, a little hairier.
It could be, but then they break out the good offense.
That's true.
We want that to happen. We want them to use the good offense. And maybe really Chiefs is the good offense week. Like, the game probably won't matter, but they're still going to play. Like, they're going to try to win. They're going to do everything they can to try to beat the Chiefs.
I believe you're either competing or you're not.
Well, resting your starters in week 17, if you've already clinched a playoff seed, is not competing. You're still competing, because sometimes competing is a long-term thing.
Yes.
But they will be all the way competing, and that's a good offense game. But in the meantime, lock up the playoff spot. They've played well on the road this season. The offense has played very well on the road this season, especially after the first couple weeks. It's an arm's length game. I'm telling you, they're going to win by 10 points.
Chances of victory?
70%. 75%.
That's funny, because I was going 75%. As usual, you'll talk all this like hype about how great it's going to be and then say a slightly lower percentage than I'd say.
I mean, I have a healthy level of nervousness about this.
Okay.
I just told you that Nick Mullins is a better quarterback than Kirk Cousins.
I mean,
we all know that.
There's only 84 million reasons that Kirk Cousins would be considered a better quarterback than Nick Mullins.
How does Nick Mullins rate statistically?
You know, the take I wanted to get off is that he was playing similar this year to Jimmy Garoppolo at the end of last year.
Yeah.
And that does not bear out in terms
Jimmy
of QBR.
Jimmy Garoppolo was actually pretty amazing.
Jimmy Garoppolo had like an 81 QBR at the end of last year. Some people were really convinced that that was for real. Some people were convinced
compare,
about it.
Can DVOA-wise, Kirk Cousins to Nick Mullins?
I mean, let's do QBR, because I think that's a better measure for quarterback play
okay.
in particular.
All right.
You're standing for this? Is that exciting?
Fired up about it.
Okay, so Nick Mullins does not appear to be ranked in this version, but I know that he is about a 63, and Kirk Cousins is a 63.
Look, Nick Mullins is like, how do you know he's a 63?
Because I looked. Oh no, actually, I guess he's not. He's only a 59. So Kirk Cousins does rate better by QBR. Nick Mullins only rates better by QBR than Aaron Rodgers. I feel like we have to stop on that note.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.